Hello and welcome to This Week in Wealth, a brand new podcast from Citywire RAA, in which we recap and discuss some of the biggest stories from the last 7 days. I'm Alex Steger, and I'm once again joined by Ian Wenick.
Happy to be here.
And Sam Bojarski.
Hey, great to be here.
Sam and Ian, thank you both very much indeed for being here. So, Ian, you were going to kick us off this week, and we were going to talk about Focus Financial Partners. Now, for a lot of the time that you and I have been writing about RAAs, the news with Focus was always, they've done a big deal. And then it became, they're going to list. And then it became, they're going to go private. But now, that stuff's not really what's going on. So talk to us a little bit about what the story was this week and how it speaks to where Focus is at the moment.
So the big news this week was that Focus Financial Partners, they renamed their biggest individual partner firm as Focus Partners Wealth. Now, that originally was this combined Franken company of Buckingham Wealth Partners and the Colony Group.
Just for a moment here, let's talk about the size of the firm involved. So the Buckingham Colony sort of merged entity was give or take how big?
It's about $115 billion in combined assets, and that includes wealth assets and investment outsourcing assets.
Okay, and just a firm changing name can be like a little bit of a so what story. So what's interesting about the fact that they've made this change?
So the first read is, if you're a Mel Brooks fan, you're thinking, is this the Judean People's Front versus the People's Front of Judea? And it's easy
Mel Brooks, Monty Python?
I thought that was History of the World.
I think that's Life of Brian.
I might be wrong.
We'll keep this in because I think I'm right. Anyway, let's continue.
Anyway, I think that there is something deeper here because the Colony-Buckingham merger was the biggest step that Focus has taken since the company sold itself to Clayton DeBilly & Rice, big private equity firm.
So this is what it went from being a public company to being a private company. And then it started, I think this is what you're getting to, it started this, the creation of hubs. And we talk about this internally because you would always talk about hubs and get very excited about them. And I say, Ian, what is a hub? Does the reader care what a hub is? So convince me.
So what a hub is basically a vehicle for internal acquisitions. So the Focus that went private was a confederation of about 90 different firms, each with different brand names, different CEOs, different ways of operating. And Focus has basically taken five of its biggest partner firms across five different business lines, and they have put themselves and the management of these wealth managers all on the same page. And what those five hubs are doing is they're merging in as many of these existing Focus affiliates as possible to go from 90 to maybe it goes down to a couple dozen if there are a few that say, I don't want to take the deal. I want to keep operating independently under my own business name.
Got it. Okay. So it's like a sort of a series of internal mergers based around the largest existing partner firms.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And let's take a step back. I alluded to this a little bit in my opening here about sort of what we used to write about when it came to Focus. So take us back in time. So this seems a little bit boring, you know, internal mergers doesn't seem quite as exciting as what we used to do, which was write about just big external acquisitions. So maybe take us just for a minute for those less up to speed on everything Focus than you, which is probably everyone except for people who work at the company. Give us the sort of, you know, a brief history of Focus Financial and how we've got to this point.
History of the World Part 1. So Focus has basically been trading hand through private equity and public ownership for about a decade plus. So the company was founded by a couple of McKinsey alums around the mid-2000s. They brought in private equity backing first from Summit Partners, then from Centerbridge, then from Stone Point, then from KKR. The company went public in 2018, and for a couple of years, it was really the only publicly traded analog to the RE industry.
And up until that point, effectively, its business model was borrow money, go out and buy RAAs, and not really smash them together, just let them all sit on its platform as part of its company.
Exactly. And they had a massive, massive first mover advantage. I mean, so much of the consolidation that we're seeing now and so much of this external private equity investment, None of that happens without Focus going on those initial acquisition sprees in the 2000s and early to mid 2010s.
Okay. So then I interrupted you on your timeline. So they'd gone public. They were sort of the only real public RIA, effectively, but they didn't stay public for that long.
Yes. And I think the reason they didn't stay public for particularly long there were a couple of factors. One was the company's leverage position, which sat at around 4 times its earnings for the bulk of its time in the public markets. And so for a publicly traded financial services company, that looks a little bit high. For wealth managers, which have gone through 2, 3, 4 rounds of private equity backing, Focus was actually on the low side. So that leverage position was a drag on the stock for a number of years, as was the question of where does the organic growth come from beyond just market appreciation? And so Focus ran into issues a little bit when it classified acquisitions carried out by existing partner firms as a form of same-store sales. That's not the organic growth we think of when we think of organic growth for RIAs.
Okay, and so then in 23, it was taken private again?
Yes.
And since then, what's the strategy been? Because they do seem to be doing less big, notable external acquisitions.
Yes, and I think that what we've seen the last couple of years basically justifies CD&R's thesis.
CD&R, the new
private equity owners. So there's been total overhaul in the company C-suite. All three of those founders that we've discussed, Rudy Adolf, Rajini Kodiala, Lenny Chang, they've all moved on. There's been
some... Did they do all right on the deal? They did okay out of it?
We calculated that down to the cent.
Yeah.
That was a fun project.
Don't worry about them. They're going to be okay. Yeah.
So they've moved on, and there's been a total overhaul of the company's C-suite. There have been some people that have moved on in the home office. But the leadership structure now is the former Colony CEO, Michael Nathanson. He's now the leader of Focus Financial Partners. And then the chief executive of Buckingham, Adam Birenbaum, is now running the company now known as Focus Partners Wealth, which was this $115 billion half Colony, half Buckingham. So those two guys have known each other for years. So there's a strong dialogue between the two of them.
Okay. And just my final question on the hub plan then. So this was something that you think they couldn't have done as a public company, but that it is sort of key to the strategy as a private company.
Absolutely. And I think part of it is just we've been writing about these hub deals since I believe we wrote about Colony becoming the first hub in November of 2023. So we're talking about a process of these internal mergers, buyouts, getting people on the same page equity-wise. This has been going on for, we're coming up on 18 months pretty soon. And you think about how public companies are almost managed on a quarter-to-quarter basis, the type of long-term time horizon that CD&R and the Focus leadership has been operating under, you can't do that when you're answering quarter-to-quarter and people are saying, hey, how many deals have you guys done? And, you know, I was doing a scan of the old Focus press release before we came on. I don't think, with the caveat that we might have missed something, Focus has not brought in a new external partner firm, done an external acquisition, just joined the Focus network. And almost, I think about a little more than coming up on 2 years now.
Okay. So, but rather instead, what they're focused on is sort of, you know, synergies effectively.
Yes.
And having a more integrated practice and having more firms sort of doing all of the same thing rather than this disparate, I can't remember how you described it, sort of network, a loose affiliation of hundreds or 90.
Exactly, because at the end of the day, you don't need 90 chief compliance officers. You don't need 90 different systems around trading or operations. You don't need 90 different heads of marketing. So there clearly are synergies and cost cuts to be found without affecting the overall advisor-client relationship and those profit margins. And we're talking about something that's been, you know, we're talking about an 18-month time horizon. That's a big difference versus every single quarter, 3 months, you're answering to analysts, how far along have you come? You know, it's like, it's a lot easier to clean your room when you don't have your parents knocking on the door and saying, have you made your bed yet?
I don't know, as a father of two small children, if you're not on their case, that room's not getting cleaned. But anyway, Sam, I want to bring you in here because Not only was there this sort of rebrand within Focus, which, as discussed, speaks to something more, there was another one of these hub mergers. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, one of those current hub firms, SCS Financial, which recently was rebranded to SCS Focus Partners Family Office and OCIO,
Snappy name.
Yeah, yeah, very snappy.
Crucially getting the word Focus in there, I think. Yeah.
They've merged with two existing Focus partners, Lake Street Advisors and Edge Capital Group. And that was revealed yesterday, I believe, on Wednesday.
Okay. And is there a rhyme or reason as to sort of why certain firms within Focus go to a specific hub?
Yeah, now they're kind of trying to make each hub sort of a specialty firm. SCS, as their name suggests, family office, and they have an outsourced chief investment offering. So
it's very investment focused, focused on those sort of higher net worth,
exactly, big, ultra high net worth,
sophisticated, accredited investors,
that ultra high net worth client base. Yeah. Yeah, and then you know, Focus has partner firms in Canada, Australia. They made one of their Canadian firms, Cardinal Point, into a hub as well.
For the international business or for the Canadian?
I think just Canada for now.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a sort of, there's a logic to it. So you end up with a smaller number of specialized, I'll say the word. I'll say hub. So yeah. I don't like it in headlines, but I'll say it out loud. Okay, fantastic. Very useful. And so what, I guess we're entering the realm of speculation, but it's a fun place to be. What can we expect to see from Focus over 25? Is it just more of the same, or do you think it is only your guess, it doesn't have to be based in fact, that they've kind of reached a tipping point on this and then there's a different sort of dynamic or agenda to what they do for the rest of the year?
I don't know if we've reached a tipping point quite yet. So when we wrote the story on Monday about the rebrand, there had been at that point, I believe, 14 of these kind of internal merger transactions that had taken place. The two that Sam wrote about on Thursday that pushes up to 16. I mean, we're talking about a business that had 90 to start. There's still a long, long, long runway. So I think you're going to have to deal with seeing Hub in a lot of headlines in the coming months, much to your chagrin.
Yeah, well, we'll see if they make it through to the final version. Sam, you very politely had your hand up there.
They indicated at the beginning of the month too that external deal making should start picking up this year as well. I know that's been few and far between lately since the take private transaction, but that should start picking up.
Okay, revenge for me then. You know, the more exciting headline. But yeah, fair enough. Okay, so a little bit of both, effectively for the coming year. Fantastic. Okay, well, changing tack now somewhat. Sharply away from business strategy and RIA deals to the SEC. So we talked about it a bit last week. Sam, you gave us a very good and clear outline as to what we might be able to expect under the new SEC commissioner and the Trump administration. And in our conversation last week, listener, if you didn't listen, go back and listen. It's a cracker. It's the beginning of this podcast series. You want to be there from the start. Have a listen to it. But in that conversation, we also talked specifically about these off-channel communication fines that have been one of the SEC's sort of enforcement focuses over the last sort of couple of years. Now, this SEC, under its current leadership and administration, is clearly coming to an end in a matter of days. But it has not gone quietly, specifically on that front.
Yeah, I mean, this week we saw there were a group of 12 firms that agreed to pay, I think, $63 million in combined penalties. And then two of Robinhood's broker-dealer businesses paid a combined $45 million. And part of that was due to off-channel communication texting.
Yeah, a flurry of fines from the SEC in this
flurry,
last...
Yes.
In this last. Yeah, I think that's the correct collective noun here. Okay, but you had a story this week which goes a bit deeper than this, which speaks to not just what the SEC has been doing, but how this plays out in practice. And it basically involves firms, advice firms, tapping their advisors' phones. Have I got that right? Can you explain?
Yeah, that's essentially what ends up happening. But basically, the SEC will kind of initiate enforcement action against a firm for off-channel communications if they have some evidence that they're doing it. Maybe they received a tip, what have you. And then they will go to that firm, and that firm will kind of work with their legal counsel. SEC examiners will typically have a list of employees who they think might be texting clients on unapproved communication channels. And what will happen is the firm might work with their legal counsel to kind of install a software on their phone that might be investigating whether or not they have done this in the past.
Okay. And then at that point, what the SEC and their lawyers, sorry, the advice firm and its lawyers go to the SEC and say, here are some records?
Yeah. They say, hey, here's what we've been able to come up with. Here's what's happening. Here's what we haven't been able to find. And that'll kind of influence the settlement process. It'll, influence that number we ultimately see in their press releases.
And then if let's say you're an advisor and you've had this software put on your phone, and the fine has come and gone, the firm has settled with the SEC, what happens to your phone now? Do you continue to be monitored? What's next, I guess?
I think it really depends. There's always a little bit of like give and take in the remedial action that the SEC agrees with in collaboration with the firm. They often have to change their policies and procedures related to communications. Sometimes it's a matter of like bringing in an outside vendor to help archive communications. So I think in some cases, like yes, maybe they'll end up using this technology.
And I suppose this slightly depends on whether we think this is going to be an enforcement focus for the new SEC, let's call it, for the sake of argument. But assuming that it was, then is this something that advisors should effectively expect to kind of become commonplace, that you have some sort of software on your personal devices that monitor it, for this purpose?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely going to become more commonplace. And I mean, RIAs have evaluated adding software like this, even independent of SEC actions, because clients like increasingly want to text their advisors.
They want that more informal communication.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, but I guess the flip side of this is that it might not become as prevalent because this whole sort of area of enforcement, the kind of off-channel comms thing, is something that we think the incoming commissioner is not so keen on. And I know we talked about this a little bit last week, but could you recap on that point?
Yeah, that's certainly what he's indicated. I mean, he's been pretty critical of like the overhanded enforcement approach of the current SEC. He's talked a little bit about texting, about off-channel communication specifically. And, I think the SEC is probably still going to enforce the law, but we might not see actions as frequently, perhaps. We might not see like these big ticket penalties.
Okay, fantastic. Well, look, I think those are two of the biggest stories of the week. I'm sure by the time this comes out, Citywire RIA would have broken at least two other massive stories. That's just what we do, right, Ian? But anything else before we go, before we sign off for the week, anything else on your minds that the readers should be aware of?
Yeah, I would say we kicked off our first big sale process of the year. If you read our Thursday afternoon newsletter, you got the scoop that Stewart Partners, $38 billion hybrid RIA, is going for a sale, looking for a new controlling owner. And I'll be curious to see what kind of valuation they get and whether they're going to be able to crack $1 billion enterprise value.
Yeah, and indeed, per previous conversations that we've had, what kind of buyer, probably too small for a sovereign, would we gamble there?
Yeah, we wrote, so they were interviewing bankers as far back as June of 2024, and our sources told us at the time that it's probably going to be a private equity firm coming in, and something in that like $750 to $1 billion enterprise value range. I mean, that's right in the sweet spot for a lot of these Genstar Capital, Lightyear Capital, a lot of these mid-market specialist PE shops that have taken such a liking to our business in the last couple of years.
Fantastic. Well, some things never change, apparently, and 2025 looks set to be another busy year for RIA deal making. Ian and Sam, thank you both very much indeed for joining me for our second ever episode of This Week in Wealth.